Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
We are in show 26.
Yes.
We are in not the best of times. But as
mildly.
We said before, things will get worse.
Yes, they will. And the man that we're going to talk about today is the perpetrator of
all of that.
Making it worse now. Diocletian. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to be looking at Diocletian as he reconstructs the empire. It's going to be rather complex, so you're going to have to put your little cap on there, the thinking cap, and then maybe even if you have a map of the Roman Empire, it might be of some help.
Okay.
I'm hoping that when we eventually get this particular program up on the internet and on the website, I'll get a map along with that so that people who are looking at it are listening to the program by way of their computer would be able to see where we're talking about.
I'm sure that would be very helpful.
We'll try to walk through that. So it's a little complex, but it's worth holding on to because Diocletian is an incredibly important individual, and how we see how he spins out of control and brings about the worst persecution in church history is certainly an important lesson for us, and an important lesson too because of the martyrs and what they went through for us in order to pass the faith on for us. You know, we just studying periods like this, I think we really have a better sense of the preciousness of that faith that's been handed on to us, the faith of our fathers, you know, that's been handed on to us, and mothers.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of women who suffered in this also.
Blood of the martyrs. Again.
Blood of the martyrs. Yeah, yeah. Well, we left off last time with the Emperor Aurelian. They'd gone through a whole series, and I think I just mentioned in passing that he himself was assassinated by his generals. Mm-hmm. It was actually as a result of a little dirty act on the part of his own secretary, who had forged documents, which were execution documents for these generals. And the generals preempted what they thought was an order to have them arrested, and they killed the emperor instead. So this whole thing was done by a secretary.
Wow.
Yeah. And the end result...
Rough times.
Yeah, it is. And it's going to get worse, too. Mm-hmm. But he certainly stands in the tradition of the Roman Empire in that there is no such thing as imperial retirement plans. that just doesn't happen. Actually, Diocletian does have an imperial retirement plan, but he's one of the few. In fact, if you look at the emperors and begin with Commodus and his murder in 192 A.D., from that point up until the coming of Diocletian, there are 28 legitimate emperors. That's not including the usurpers and the pretenders and the wannabes, but 28. That means the average emperor lasted 3.3 years.
Wow.
Now,
that's turmoil.
Yes. And of the 28 emperors, 22 of them were murdered. Yeah, so this is really rough. And what happens after Aurelian's murder is not anything better. You've got, he's succeeded by Claudius Tacitus, who lasts 1 year. He's succeeded by Probus, who lasts 6 years. That's pretty extraordinary. And then he's succeeded by Carus and his two sons. All told, they lasted 2 years.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And what makes it even more extraordinary is that Carus is killed not by the Praetorian Guard, not by some assassin, but by a lightning bolt.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, like, what are the chances? But he was out and about, and bam, he got zapped, and you know, people looked around like, whoa. I want to tell you about, this is an opportunity to step back and tell you about a wonderful little story about lightning bolts.
Okay.
And I think you might know the story about the 12th Legion.
Yes,
okay.
I remember that.
But I don't think we really talked about it much earlier, and I'd like to say something about it now, about lightning bolts. Now, we have to go back about 100 years, and Marcus Aurelius is the emperor at the time. He has a border war, a skirmishing war, along the Danube River. This is back in 171 A.D.
Okay.
And there is an alliance of several Germanic tribes, the Macromanni, the Quadi, and some other German tribes, and they crossed over the Danube River. And so he was gathering his troops together in order to stop them. However, he got caught in a forest, an area. Well, it was a field, but there was a forest on one side. He got caught with only one legion, and he was up against an entire Germanic army.
Wow.
They were terribly outnumbered, and it was the 12th Legion. And this is a famous legion. This legion had participated in the siege of Jerusalem back in 70 AD.
Right.
Anyway, there they are. And the legionaries, here's the key. The legionaries saw that they were all going to get slaughtered. And rather than prepare to fight and go to their death, they went to their knees and they began praying. Out of the blue, a storm came up, including lightning strikes, only on the German side, not on the Roman side. And the Germans were routed by lightning. This is an extraordinary thing. And their historians, both Christian and pagan historians, attest that this has in fact happened. And so when this was all over, then they stood back up. There's this torrent of rain and everything else caused the Germans to retreat. And everyone recognized it was a miracle.
Yes.
But the question was, whose miracle?
Yes.
And the Christian soldiers, and I think this is an important point, is that division, that legion was made up of many, many Christian soldiers. The Christians said it was because we went to our knees and we prayed to Jesus Christ to save us.
Okay.
And he did.
Uh-huh.
Well, an apologist, Christian apologist, used that often. You find this story mentioned several times. But on the other hand, there was another guy that jumps forward and he goes, oh, no, it was done by an Egyptian magician, fellow by the name of Ornithus, who had invoked the Egyptian god Thoth, who is in Greek Hermes, and in Romans Mercury. So you have Christians that are saying, no, it was Jesus Christ who did it, and others that are saying, no, it was an Egyptian magician who had brought down Thoth, which is Mercury. When Marcus Aurelius got back to Rome, and this is where we're going to see his real attitude, when he got back to Rome, he built a temple to Mercury.
Oh.
He ignored the Christians. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Roman soldiers carry a large shield. You know, it's called the scutus, and the scuti, these shields, said about 3 feet tall and about a foot and a half wide, kind of a rectangular kind of a deal. And ever since then, two sets of lightning bolts were on that shield. And you can see that even to today. In fact, there are reenactors in Europe, like we have Civil War reenactors here in America. There are reenactors also in Europe, and there is a group in France that has actually reconstructed the 12th Legion. And they've got a neat website.
Oh.
And when you look at those shields, they've got the lightning bolts on them.
Oh, my gosh. Do you happen to know that website? I'll have to look it up. That is really...
I think the best thing to do is just to Google France plus 12th Legion.
12th Legion.
Yeah, and you'd get it. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. I do want to go see that.
Yeah. Well, at the time of the murder of Probus and Carus and his two sons coming to the throne, and so I'm jumping back forward again another 100 years. I just wanted to tell you that little story about the 12th Legion. But as we go back up into our own time period, we're finding that this empire, which is killing emperors one after another, it's being attacked. It's being attacked from the east. The Persians are on the rise. That's present-day Iran, of course. They're on the rise. And then Carus himself is killed by... this thunderbolt. His son is with him at the time, and immediately he has proclaimed the emperor. They're out in the east fighting the Persians.
Okay.
He then is made the emperor. His name is Numerianus, and he begins a retreat. And as he's retreating, he goes blind. There's some sort of a disease or something, the best we can tell. But it gets worse and worse. And by the time he reached the Bosporus Straits, that's in Turkey between, you know, Asia Minor and Europe, he's in an enclosed carriage, and nobody is allowed in or out.
Wow.
And when he gets to the Bosporus, they had to open the carriage in order, and he was dead.
Oh, my gosh.
He was dead. The soldiers blamed it blamed his death on the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. And his name is Aper. Okay. And they blamed him for this. And so they proclaimed another soldier, another officer, as the next emperor. And it turns out that he's the son of an ex-slave from Illyria, which would be like the Croatian area today.
Okay.
And this is Diocletian.
Oh.
So this is a man who came from very humble start. I mean, his father was an ex-slave. And so he's come up through the ranks. He is a ruthless individual right from the very beginning. The very first thing he does is he eliminates his potential rival, Aper, and he puts up a trial. There's no evidence that Aper had anything to do with this young man's death. Then he calls down a judgment. This is a Diocletian. Without any evidence, has this trial, calls down a judgment by the sole Invictus, that is to say, the undefeated, the invincible son, S-U-N, okay? And he professes his own innocence in the death of this young man, and then goes over himself to Aper and draws a sword and slays him right there, right in front of everybody, the trial, the whole Roman army. And, boy, they know that they've got some guy who's pretty ruthless. There is a druid priestess who has already predicted that Diocletian would become the emperor of Rome. Now, how on earth she came up with that, I don't know. But she had said that the sign of his ascension would be the slaying of a boar. You know, the boar, you know, like a wild pig.
A pig. Uh-huh.
Right, okay. The word for boar in Latin at the time was aper. Whoa.
Oh,
so
gosh.
Everyone's looking at this stuff going, uh-oh, augur, you know. His only rival is Carus's other son, who wasn't with him. He was back in the West, and his name is Carinus. Okay. So he's got to have to deal with him, he thinks, until he finds out that one of Carinus's tribunes, one of his generals, killed him, too.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is kind of rough.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, then, the whole imperial mess falls to Diocletian. He's the only man. He's the last man standing. Now, let's take a look at the Roman Empire and the situation that he's inheriting. There's a plague that's ravaging the empire, killing off thousands of people, demoralizing citizens. As a result, there is a lack of agricultural workers because many of these were farmers. So if you don't have agricultural workers, you don't have food, and therefore famine. So you got plague and famine. Add to that the invasion of so many neighbors. The Germans are on the move. The Scythians are on the move. That's that area around southern Russia, what is the Ukraine today.
Okay.
Those people are on the move. The Persians are on the move again. After they were able to see these emperors killed, they began coming back again. All throughout the empire, you've got gangs of brigands. Gangs, literally, and they're roaming wherever. There are barbarian hordes that simply roam, a couple thousand people that just roam around, and they're unopposed. The army is not able to keep them at the borders, not able to deal with them, and so they can't address all the challenges. The population of the people themselves have come to rely so much on the professional army that if you're not a soldier, you don't know how to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no Second Amendment in ancient Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a weapon. You don't know what to do. What do? You build a wall around your city. And that's what happened was they began building walls around the cities and then hiding in these walls, hiding behind these walls. And that's the only way they were able to survive. So this is a population of people that is unable to defend itself.
Mm-hmm.
Things are in terrible shape. Some people, even so far, and then added to that, the currency is debased. Okay, they're adding all kinds of junk on the currency, so that causes inflation. So now you've got too much money chasing after too few goods. Mm-hmm. The farms are being abandoned. What happens is now in the countryside, the farm families that had at least been, you know, productive, they flee to wealthy people. These are people who own estates up on top of hills, mm-hmm. and they're fortifying their own palaces in on these hills. And the farmers are going to them saying, "We'll work for you if you protect us." Mm-hmm. And so the term for that estate is a latifundia. Okay, and what happens is that these families are literally selling themselves into serfdom. Mm-hmm. They're not slaves, technically, mm-hmm. but they're no longer free to leave. And so these wealthy owners of these plantations, really, the latifundiae, are going to hire in strong men to protect them, mm-hmm. and then to protect their property, which includes those farm families.
Right.
You see where we're going here?
Yes.
It's not pretty. Diocletian. Now, what are you going to do? The first thing he did was he got all dressed up. He got out of his military uniform, and he put on this incredible purple robe. He's not wearing a toga, a big, long purple robe with a crown with all kinds of jewels on it. And everyone that came into his presence had to face him at all times. You couldn't show your back to the emperor. The court was full of all kinds of pomp and mm-hmm. circumstance. The reason why he was doing this is he wanted to give everybody a sense that he's different. He's got an aura of invincibility about him.
He's
Don't even
charge.
Try to kill him.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He's the one who's in charge. Yeah. And so he's determined. This is a man who is determined to serve out his empire. He's going to solve the problems, and then he's going to retire. And the reason we know he's going to retire is because he's built a retirement home on the seacoast. Beautiful place, and so, but he's got work to do before he gets there. He chose an aide to work with him. His name is Marcus Aurelius Maximian. Now, I've got to warn you here. There are going to be a lot of Roman names going around,
right,
and
right.
So let's see if we can't keep these harmonized. So you've got Diocletian, mm-hmm. okay, and then you've got Maximian. Okay, and Maximian is going to be put in charge of a part of the empire, and he'll be given like a vice presidency.
Okay.
Okay. Here is another man who is not a Roman. He's actually from Pannonia, which is present-day Austria.
Oh, okay.
He's been a longtime soldier and an assistant to Diocletian as he rose up through the ranks. And in 285, Diocletian gives him the title Caesar. He takes the title Augustus.
Okay.
And then what it meant then was that, and this is for the first time, you really have somebody who is set up as the successor. The Romans were terrible about thinking about who's going to succeed. Part of the reason for that was if you set up a successor, he'll kill you, and then he'll succeed.
Right.
So they avoided that by never doing it. Now Diocletian trusts Maximian enough in order to give him that title and say, look, when I'm finished, you're the guy.
When I go to the coast, this is your business.
That's right, yeah. And so he then sends him off to prove it.
Okay.
And he sends him to Gaul. In 286, and he successfully campaigns in Gaul, pacifies what is present-day France,
okay,
and is able to restore order. So the rebels are put down, the Germans are chased out, the brigands are brought to justice, and so with that, everything seems to be pretty good.
Okay.
Now, Diocletian accepts Maximian as a co-ruler. Now, to us, this seems very strange. You've got to have one man in charge.
Right.
But the Romans had always had two men in charge at all times. They always had a veto power over each other. Even going back to the Republic, you had two consuls that they were serving at the same time. And so for the Romans, this wasn't such a big deal. But what is important is that you now have a line of succession.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, all the more. Interesting thing happens during that campaign in Gaul. As Maximian was marching his troops to Gaul, and he's up in northern Italy, okay, this is in 286, one of the legions that is involved in this this cleaning operation, this mopping up operation, is known as the Theban Legion.
Okay.
And this legion is from Thebes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there are a lot of Christians in that legion. And again, it shows us that many Roman soldiers were Christians. Christians got into the military. And so Maximian calls upon all of the soldiers before they begin the attack. He calls upon all the soldiers to sacrifice to the gods, mm-hmm. and swear that they will fight the what's known as the Bagards. That's a Celtic word, Bagat, meaning a peasant warrior. Okay, and Christians. He's blaming what's going on in Gaul on the Christians. Now, his own Christian soldiers are called upon to sacrifice to the pagan gods and swear an allegiance to attack and kill Christians. They refuse.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is he decimates that that particular legion. This was done, actually, it's in Switzerland itself, in the Swiss city of Saint Maurice. And at the time it was known as the Agunum, the village of Agunum. And the information that we have on this mainly comes from a Christian monk of the 7th century. Although it goes back actually in the 400s, there are writings that talk about this decimation that took place. Most likely it was a decimation of the Christian troops. Now, mm-hmm. a decimation means that you line everybody up and then you walk down the line and every 10th man is then taken out and killed. That's a decimation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty powerful military discipline. Anyway, then the campaign goes on, and as I had said before, is successful. However, he's not successful when he gets to the English Channel. Over on the other side, in Britain itself, Carinus, remember the son of Carus. Escapes. Okay, escapes from the clutches of Maximian and the Roman soldiers, and he makes his way over to Britain, and he organizes the Britons as well as some of the Gauls as well as pirates on the. It's kind of strange to think about pirates on the English Channel, but there were, and he organizes them all together into this force, and Maximian was not able to defeat it. Didn't have a navy, for one thing, and so ultimately he had to make peace, at least for a while. Diocletian and Maximian made peace with Carinus, and they agreed that he would be also another co-emperor. This is the temporary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, until they can get to him, that this is going to be a temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Then they turn their attention to the German borders. There's a revolt in Alexandria down in Egypt. Once again, they turn their attention there. In Upper Egypt, there is a tribe that's making raids all the way to the Delta itself, which is very important. The Egyptian Delta provides lots and lots of grain for the city of Rome and also provides almost all the paper of the entire empire. So they had to deal with that. There's a riot in Carthage. They have to deal with that. Way over in what is now Morocco and Mauritania, again, there's a problem there. You've got more German tribes on the Danube River. You've got the Persians again. And finally then, in 291, Diocletian and Maximian meet in Milan, and they realize they're going to have to do something really radical in order to save this empire. And what they did then was they decided that they needed to bring in two more men, and they would divide the empire instead of in two. Diocletian was operating in the east, and Maximian was operating in the west. They decided what they needed to do was split the empire into two parts, and then subdivide each part into two parts. So there'd be four parts. But they're not breaking up the empire. They're breaking up the administrative responsibilities.
Okay.
So they look around for some people who are really, really good, that they can rely on and are also very effective. And one of those is another Croatian, by the name of Constantius. And his nickname was Chlorus, Constantius Chlorus.
Okay.
Chlorus means pale face, because he had a very, very light complexion. Anyway, he is the chief of the Praetorians for Maximian. He is an ill man. He's a weak constitution, but he's very brave and very virtuous and respected by everybody. And so he then is going to be brought in. He's important because of his second wife. This is a woman by the name of Helena. Now, I said it was his wife, but it was a common law marriage. And the reason for that was that Helena came from a lower class. She was actually the daughter of a hotel owner. And anyway, they loved each other, but we had talked about before, the Romans had this deal about not being able to marry outside of your class. And so although they loved each other, they were not able to formally marry, and so they adopted this this common law marriage. She has a son by Constantius. His name is Constantine.
Wow.
You've probably heard that name before.
Yeah.
Yes. And then when he was made Caesar, when Constantius was made Caesar, then he had to marry, and he had to marry inside of his class. And so with that, he had to put Helena aside, though she's always going to be near him. Mm-hmm. He has to put her aside. He has to marry the stepdaughter of Maximian,
okay,
a woman by the name of Theodora. Now, we don't know for a fact that Helena at this point, this is that great Helena that had built all those churches, that's a couple episodes away.
Right. Uh-huh.
But this is who that woman is. We don't know that she was actually a Christian at this time. We don't know that for a fact. But Constantine himself will say that as a boy, that she gave him, and these are his words, the food of piety.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And also they had a daughter. Besides Constantine, they had a daughter by the name of Anastasia, which is Greek for resurrection.
Oh, my God.
So, okay. I don't know. So, anyway, that's the... So what you have then is, trying to keep this all straight, mm-hmm, you've got over in the west, you've got Maximian, who is the Augustus, and then his understudy, the Caesar, who is Constantius, who has a Christian influence in his family. We know that. On the other side, you've got Diocletian, and he's looking for somebody who is also going to be able to aid him as his Caesar. And he chooses another Illyrian. So that coastline is producing a lot of people, leaders. This is a guy who's a farmer.
Okay.
Okay. He had been, an agricultural worker. He became a soldier. His name is Galerius. And Galerius is a big man. Just big. He's one of these guys that if he walks into the tent, everybody steps back. Yeah. He's also brutal. And he's also ignorant.
Oh, no.
This is a man who has not been educated at all. He's respected by Constantius is respected by the troops, not because of his size or strength. He doesn't have that, but because of his virtue.
Mm-hmm.
He is a good man. Galerius is respected because of the size.
Big.
Yeah. And the fact that if you step on, he'll
take
you
care of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you don't want. He is courageous, and he has street smarts. Mm-hmm. And he also, turns out, although he's ignorant, that is to say he's not educated, he does have a friend who teaches him a lot, and it teaches him especially about Persian things. So he learns a little of the Persian language. He learns a lot about Persian culture. His friend happens to be an exiled king of Persia, Tiridates. And so all four then are gathered together in Milan, and they then begin looking at how they're going to solve the empire's problems.
Okay.
So Diocletian and Galerius go to the east. They're going to deal with everything in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Maximian and his new son-in-law, Constantius, they're going to go to the west.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Constantius moves his capital to Treveri, which is now the city of Trier in Germany,
okay,
on the Mosel River. One of my personally favorite cities in the world. I love Trier. It is just a gorgeous city. It has a wonderful old monument called the Porta Negra, the Black Portal, and the gates coming into the city itself. The old part, the pedestrian part of the city, is the exact layout of the Roman city.
Mm-hmm.
And in that city is a beautiful Gothic cathedral, Romanesque cathedral that the Catholic Church has. That's their cathedral there. And the Protestants have taken over the other big cathedral, which actually Constantine had given to the church when he became emperor. And it's still there.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful basilica. But anyway, there you have it. Anyway, he moves then to Trier in order to deal with his problems in Gaul and in Britain. Remember, Carinus. And Maximian stays in Milan.
So he has the southern half.
He has the southern half, yeah. Now, that's including Italy, Africa, Spain. But he also has authority in the province of Raetia, which is southern Germany.
Okay.
So that's his. Okay. Over in the east, Galerius sets up his camp, first of all, in what is now Austria.
Okay.
Sirmium, a little village of Sirmium, to oversee the actions on the Danube, Illyria itself, Macedonia, and Greece. Diocletian moves over into Asia Minor, and he sets himself up to oversee Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, Egypt, Libya, and Thrace.
Okay.
And he sets his capital at Nicomedia. Okay. For the next 5 years, it's like a Roman tag team match. Each one is fighting their enemies. Every once in a while, one of the others has a spare moment, he runs over and helps the other guy. It is seesaws back and forth. Constantius moves very quickly through Gaul, takes over the sea coasts along the North Sea, and eliminates the pirates. Then he begins working on a fleet, and his intention then is to invade Britain and to take care of Carinus. However, before he's able to build the fleet, he gets word that Carinus is murdered by his own people. So that saves him that. Then he does invade Britain nonetheless, but when he invades Britain, the people in Britain, the Romans in Britain, receive him as a hero.
Okay.
You know, they were so happy to get back into the empire.
Uh-huh.
This period of British Roman history is very sad in the sense that this is a group of people who really want to be part of the empire, but every once in a while they keep on getting dropped out,
uh-huh,
and so they're happy to be back. So things are happening. And Constantius is successful.
Okay.
Maximian pacifies North Africa. Okay. Takes care of all of that. And so the West is in pretty good shape. Over on the other side, Diocletian deals with another revolt in Alexandria. It ends up being an 8-month siege.
Wow.
I mean, these Alexandrians can be kind of ruckus.
Persistent.
Yeah. Galerius goes off for his adventure, and he attacks Persia. He walks right into a trap. Here's our Persian expert, mm-hmm. Walks right into a trap. Most of his troops are destroyed, killed by a new Persian weapon or tactic. And what it was a cavalry, heavily armored cavalry who used bows and arrows. And so the Roman soldiers, they were on foot. Mm-hmm. And so they were just constantly outmaneuvered by these guys. Galerius then takes a small band of soldiers, fights his way through, and retreats all the way back to Syria. And when he gets there, back in Antioch, he meets Diocletian, who is furious. You lost an army? What? And he refuses to even talk to him. He said for days, Galerius would go around following Diocletian, saying, please talk to me, please talk to me. And Diocletian would have nothing to do with him. This continued on, as I say, for quite a while, until finally Diocletian forgave him. And his reasoning was that after suffering such a humiliating defeat, he would never allow that to happen again to himself. And so he'll be better the next time around. So he gives him a new army.
Okay.
It's a small one, about 25,000 men. And he goes, okay, now you go back there and you whip up on those Persians. And so Galerius takes this rather small army, heads on off to fight the Persians. And then he did something that almost never happens in Roman history. He launched a night attack. Romans don't fight at night. Well, he did. And the Persians were taken by such surprise that they were overwhelmed. And what he did was he attacked those archers right in their tents before they had a chance to get on their horses.
Uh-huh.
And so he defeated the Persians totally. This was in 293. And as a result, his stock goes up in the eyes of Diocletian.
Now he's got the bows and arrows.
Yes, now he's got the bows and arrows. This is the most incredible thing.
Huh.
From the time what we call the Tetrarchy, the four rulers, take over, divide up the empire, go into this tag team match.
Uh-huh.
In 3 years, the empire is put back together again, which is quite extraordinary.
That is. And that's a lot of area.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Diocletian then establishes a whole system of promotions, again, something that had never been done in the Roman Empire, so that the best would rise to the top. And the idea was this. He took the entire Roman Empire and he abolished all of the provinces, abolished everything, and he set up 100 provinces. And inside of each of these provinces would be other administrative units based on cities that he refers to as dioceses.
Okay.
And that's where we start in the Catholic Church begin mm-hmm. using that same term. And of course, dioceses are organized around provinces. So we actually use the Diocletian system in the Catholic Church. he takes each of these provinces and he assigns an individual to oversee that province. He's given the title of a proconsul. And what happens then is that as you rule in a particular province or a diocese, you begin rising higher and higher, so that when there is a vacancy in the higher governmental positions, then the emperor can look around and find the very best of those, and then that promotion takes place. So things begin working well for the first time, and you've got some pretty good leadership. But there's a downside of this, and that is bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have a large office in order to do this. You've got so many now government officials. They all have to have secretaries. They're all sending out letters. Everything has to be notarized, just going on and on. In fact, one historian of the period complained about the taxes that in order to support this. Lactanius is the name of this historian, and he says that there came a point in time when there were more tax collectors than there were taxpayers. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the victory in Persia, Diocletian, more and more, as Galerius's star rose, deferred more and more to him. It was obvious Diocletian was now beginning to think in terms of retirement. Wasn't ready to retire yet, but thinking in terms of it, and was thinking in terms of handing the empire over to Galerius. Now, here's an interesting little aside. He even gives his daughter in marriage to Galerius. This is a wonderful young lady by the name of Valeria. And now Galerius is starting to think to himself, well, I'm pretty hot stuff. I'm married to the daughter of the emperor. The emperor's listening to me all the time. I've beaten back all of my enemies. I've beaten back the Persians. And he looks around. He doesn't have anything to fight. He's won it all. It's at this point that he starts looking for something else, another adventure. And a couple things are working on his mind. And remember, he's not exactly the brightest candle in the candelabra there. And one of those is his mother. Galerius has a mother who is beginning to get more and more influence on him. And the reason why that's important is because she is a priestess of a pagan cult. And so she is constantly talking to him about the Christians and how bad they are. Added to that, you've got a highbrow attack on Christianity at this time coming from philosophers. We mentioned a little bit about Plotinus earlier on and Porphyry. And so they go to Galerius and begin telling him, and all of a sudden he's in the company of these really respected philosophers. Well, if they're all around him, he must be pretty smart too. He adds to that pagan priests, soothsayers are getting involved. One of the reasons why they're kind of really excited about this, these soothsayers and pagan priests and augurs and all that, is because they've been recently unemployed. The reason is because there's so many underground Christians that they're not going to these guys. And so when they get an ear from somebody like Galerius. Yeah. And now, added to all of that, while he was campaigning in the East, he came across the governor of Palmyra. We'd mentioned Palmyra and Zenobia before. Now, Palmyra had been taken over by the Romans, and it's now a Roman governorship. And during his second Persian campaign, he met this man who was the governor there, his name is Heracles. And this man, this governor, had been a Christian, and he apostatized. Okay, he left the church, and instead then was, because he was rising up in ranks, was transferred from Palmyra to become the prefect of Bithynia, which is an important area of Asia Minor. In fact, the city of Nicomedia, which is the capital of Diocletian, is in Bithynia.
Okay.
So he's got a very important position, and he's also very close now to his dear friend, Galerius. And he has written a book. Okay, this is the apostate, okay, Heracles. And he wrote a book called A Friendly Discourse on Truth, in which he invites Christians to re-examine their beliefs and to put them aside and return to, as loyal Romans, to return to the old religion. And, of course, he's showing Galerius this book. And so Galerius is now won over. Since he doesn't have any military campaigns, he's looking for some campaign, and he begins to talk to Diocletian about the possibility of doing something with these Christians. Diocletian's response is, no, leave them alone.
Oh, okay.
I don't want any persecutions. And interesting, but Tourney Vents are going to change that.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But that's here. And Galerius then is not able to do anything. He tries and tries, can't convince the emperor. And so instead what happens, he just decides, okay, if I can't do it with civilians, I can do it with my army. And so what he does is he turns to his own army and begins looking for Christians within the military service. And now, as we've seen already, there are the ranks of the Roman army are filled with Christians. There are lots of Christians in serving. We have to understand that Christianity at the very beginning had a very strong pacifist sense about it.
Mm-hmm.
But over the centuries, it was seen to be, military service was seen to be an honorable profession, a good way to advance, and there's a certain amount of patriotism involved in that also. And so what happens is that in 303 A.D., he uses a little device, in which at the imperial court in Nicomedia, there had been a sacrifice to the emperor and to the Caesar, the assistant emperor, and the Diocletian was referred to as Jupiter, and Galerius was referred to as Hercules. And so everyone at the court would just worship, you know, give a little incense to them. And so that, you know, it seemed fine. Diocletian was perfectly happy with that. He knew it was, you know, kind of hokey. But on the other hand, it kind of added to his splendor, you know, as he's walking around in these big purple robes. Well, what happens is Galerius then now has his way in, and he says to Diocletian, "This was such a wonderful ceremony. I'm going to do the same thing with all my troops." And so that's how he's able to bring persecution to the empire through his own troops. And so he orders all of his troops to sacrifice a little bit of incense to the health of the emperor. Now, if you don't do that, at the very least, any Christian in the empire, or in the imperial army, who refused to do that would be demoted. In some cases, they would be literally kicked out of the army. In rare cases, they were actually martyred, and we'll see some of that and how that begins. But Diocletian is still very squeamish, even when he doesn't have the control over those troops, and Galerius does. He's still kind of squeamish at this point. So basically what happened was Christian officers would be reduced in rank. Common soldiers would receive a certificate called the ignominio, the ignominious missive, which would be a dishonorable discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean that you lost all of your benefits. The Roman soldiers could expect to serve until they're 47 years old, and then when they retired, they would receive a nice retirement, usually a nice farm someplace or money. And a lot of times they were able to choose where they wanted to be.
So islands that were inhabited.
They would lose all of that. A Christian would lose all of that as a result of it. Well, over on the other side of the empire, Maximian, who had of course done his little deed at St. Maurice, heard about this, and he'd started doing it with his troops too.
Mm.
Then all of a sudden an incident takes place in the east that turns Diocletian against the Christians. He's going to be the brake at first. He's, you know, the Galerius is the accelerator, and he's being the brake. But what happened was, at one time, there was a military operation about to take place. Diocletian brought in a number of augurs. These are people who are going to read the entrails of, you know, goats and all that kind of stuff to see whether or not it was going to be a successful campaign. All the soldiers were gathered around at this time, and these priests slit open the, you know, the animals. They read the entrails, and while they were making the entrails, some of the soldiers made the sign of the cross. the priests went crazy saying, hey, you just jinxed us. We can't tell now whether you're going to win or lose. I mean, that's bogus, but whether you're going to win or lose this battle. It ruined the whole ritual. Diocletian went into a rage over the whole thing. He ordered everybody in his army now to sacrifice. They would either be flogged and dismissed, or they did it. Now, what happens is the beginnings of this persecution is going to happen locally. It's going to begin in the soldiers' ranks themselves. And we've got some wonderful sources for this. One of those is Eusebius of Caesarea, mm-hmm. who is actually going to live toward the end of this period. So this is not ancient history for him. Mm-hmm. And then also there's another Christian historian by the name of Lactantius. And then also we have the Acts and Passions of the Martyrs. Now keep in mind, as we said before with martyrs, that you've got a sliding scale of reliability of sources. The best is court records, right. Followed after that are the passions, which is eyewitness accounts, followed after narratives that are based on documents, and then you get into sermon stories, tales, and those kinds of things.
Right.
I can dismiss the sermon stories, tales, and those kind of things, and just go for the facts, and mm-hmm. we've got plenty of facts right there. We know that in 295 that there was a young man who was conscripted into the army, and his father was a veteran. This young man, his name is Maximilian, and he's 21 years old, and he himself was a Christian. He had been influenced by Tertullian and the Montanists. And he refuses. He's a conscientious objector, and he refuses to serve. And he announces this when he's inducted into the army. He says, and I quote here, because we're getting this from court records, "I cannot be a soldier. I cannot do evil. I am a Christian." The proconsul says back in the court, he says, "Measure him," and it turns out he's 5'10". He's a pretty big guy, you know, tall for back in those days. And then the proconsul says, "Mark him." And so the soldiers grabbed him and they branded him, which is typical of, you know, for soldiers to receive a branding. It's like, you know, tattoos are today. Mm-hmm. And then and with the sign of the emperor, and he resists this. And so the proconsul turns to his father, the veteran, and says, "You know, do something about your son." And the father says, "He has a mind of his own. He knows what he's doing, so he's not going to jump in on that." And with that, the proconsul then calls in a soldier who comes over, pulls out the gladius, and slays him right then and there. In 298, another experience happens. This is on the birthday of the Emperor Maximian. This is the emperor in the west. It's his birthday. All over the empire, throughout his region, the soldiers are having banquets in honor of the emperor. And these are sacrificial banquets. And one centurion stands up in the middle of this banquet, takes off his belt, and throws it down right at the in the front of the legion's eagles. And which is like the flag, and he shouts out, "I am a soldier of Jesus Christ." This man's name is Marcellus, and immediately he's taken out and he's put on a trial. Okay, and during the trial itself, we know this because we've got the court affidavits. The court scribe, who is taking notes, all of a sudden you see his handwriting change because he stopped taking notes. And another scribe comes in to replace him because the scribe stands up. He had taken his tablet and his stylus and threw it to the ground, and he shouted out, "You have pronounced an unjust sentence." On October 30th, Marcellus, the centurion, was executed. On December 3rd, Cassius, the scribe, was executed. Both of them martyrs. All this is starting quietly. It's all starting in the army, but it soon begins to get out of hand. What we end up with then is the worst persecution ever. Galerius will live to regret being involved in this. In March of 310, he began complaining to his doctors that he had a stomach illness. Mm-hmm. What happened was that he ended up with all kinds of sores, hemorrhages. His bowels putrefied. People couldn't stand to be around him. It smelled so bad. He was a living, decaying human being. When they, his insides were moving, they were full of worms. And in his last days, he blamed himself and his role in the persecutions. And I mean, he didn't convert himself, but he then announced that the persecution was at an end. Well, it wasn't. You couldn't stop something like this now. But Lactantius, I'd mentioned before, the Christian historian, used this as an opportunity to write a book called The Deaths of the Persecutors, in which he went through and he showed every persecutor and how they met terrible deaths by standing against the Church of Jesus Christ. It makes for very graphic reading.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, next time around as we come back, we'll look at the full results of this persecution.
All right. Well, Father, that's very interesting.
Oof.
And a rough way to meet your death, apparently.
Yeah.
He recognized it, though, but however, he didn't he didn't convert.
Oh, no, no. He's too far gone at that point.
All right. Well, shall we close today with
prayer?
That's
true. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.